Hello, hello. Okay, so let's just remind ourselves where we are here. So we are in chapter three. Chapter three continues our description of the ceremony, of the Sota ceremony. So we're continuing on the narrative from, we took a quick break to talk about the oath and the curses that the priest gives to the wife, and what, and then the wife says, I mean, and what did you say, I mean, too? Took a brief detour onto that, and now we're back onto the narrative. And we did this, we did the waving, we did the order. We noticed that the verses were ambiguous as to whether the drinking was first or the offering was first. There's multiple ways to read it, and there's a machloket about all these things. And now we're going to continue along with the ceremony, and we're going to come across probably one of the best and worst Mishnayot you'll ever learn. Best because it deals with like such really interesting values and just like really interesting questions and values that are dealt with, and that's in a way it's the best. And the way it's the worst, it's just basically you'll see it's firstly it's hard to understand, but also it's quite sexist. So we'll see both of those things as we go. That'll be the next Mishnah. It's one of the best Mishnah you'll ever learn. Okay, what we have here is a question of we saw before that the wife and the husband have to consent to the ceremony in order for the ceremony to take place. What we're seeing now is when does that end? It's like at what point? Like if it happens well into the ceremony, like you've already written the scroll or you've already put it in the water, like what happens then? If then the, because the Sota ceremony is designed to eliminate doubt. So if either the wife or the husband withdraws consent for the ceremony, or it becomes totally clear that she is in fact an adulteress or not an adulteress, though the easier way is if she became an adulteress because like witnesses came forward or she admitted to it, then the Sota ceremony is totally irrelevant. That doesn't have any purpose anymore. So the question is, what happens to the stuff that you've already done if this happens, if the ceremony becomes irrelevant halfway through? So that's what this Mishnah deals with. Ad shelo nimchaka ha-megillah amra eini shota, megillata nignezet u-minchata mitpazeret al hadashen. So if up until the point where the scroll has been put into the water and has been rubbed out, if she says, I don't want to drink, she withdraws her consent from the ceremony, then the her Megillah is hidden away. There's two interpretations of this. Apparently, Rashi thinks there was essentially a Geniza next to the same root as Geniza and the Gneza to be hidden away because it has God's name in it. So there's some kind of Geniza nearby. Or according to the Yerushalmi, the Talmud Yerushalmi, there was a hinge under the door and you place the scroll there in order for it to wear away by itself over time. But nonetheless, you can't, you have to get rid of the scroll, but you can't throw it away because it's got God's name on it and you can't use it for another sota. It was specifically designated for that sota. So you couldn't, like it was written right there for her. So given that she can't, she's not going through the ceremony anymore, you have to get rid of it somehow. And in chata, her offering, you then, you sprinkle, you scatter upon the ash heap. There's ash heap in the courtyard where invalid sacrifices would be thrown. So it essentially becomes an invalid sacrifice and the priest would scatter it on the ash heap in order for it to be burnt up without, rather than use the offering for eating or anything else. We saw that there was a handful that was sprinkled on the altar and the rest of it could be eaten by the Kohanim, that's what we saw last time. So that's what happens as long as the scroll hasn't been rubbed out, as long as God's name is still intact. What I'm not sure about is this phrase, Ad shelo nimchaka ha-megillah, does that mean that if it was put in the water and the writing was still on it, and then she said, I don't want to drink, and then you take it out and the writing is still there? Like, I don't know if this is really just a way of saying until you've put it in the water or specifically until the actual writing is rubbed out. There's a slight ambiguity there. Okay, I'm going to guess that it's the latter, that it's about the writing itself because of, I think it makes what happens later a little bit more sensible. And this is, I already said this, but the Mishnah said it apparently, that the her scroll is not fit to use for any other sota. There's a close reading of the verses that could get you there, which is that the priest writes writes the scroll for her, and that might come to exclude writing for anybody else. But I think there's also just a more sort of reasoned, like a common sense answer, which is just basically, yeah, like this whole ceremony was built for her. She's not a sota anymore, so the ceremony is null and void, but you can't just reuse the paper. Okay. Nimchaka ha-megillah. But if it comes after that, that she that the writing has been rubbed out, but amrat me'ani, and she says, I did it, I admit, I'm an adulteress. Hamayim nishpachin u'minchata mitpazeret al hadashin. Then the water would be, sorry about that noise, I don't know what that was. The water is poured out on the ground, and her offering is also sprinkled on the deshen, on the ash heap. The point here is that the doubt has been totally erased, right? She has come along and said, here is the doubt is gone. She is no longer needs, she no longer needs the sota ceremony. She would just be divorced and lose her ketubah. That's the end. So there's no reason for this ceremony yet. But nonetheless, the water already has God's name in it. She can't drink it. They can't use it for anything else. So they pour it on the ground. And similarly, her offering can't be used. So they put it to a side. Now, then the last case, nimchakah ha-megillah ba'amra eini shota, if it comes to the case of writing has been rubbed away and she says, I don't want to drink, ma'arimota umashkinota ba'al korcha, they pour it into her mouth, essentially, and make her drink against her will. So that is the point where her consent no longer matters. If the writing has gone away, her consent no longer matters. I think the basic point is because God's name has already been destroyed. Like God's name has been destroyed for her. Like that is the point where it doesn't matter anymore what she thinks, or maybe even the husband. Like there could be a version of it. I don't know what the Mishnah doesn't say explicitly what the husband's consent is in these circumstances. It could also be that the husband can't stop the ceremony at that point. Like I think the point is that God's name has been erased. And therefore, that's too serious. Like God has already been involved. We have to complete the ceremony. We have to remove the doubt. How often did this happen that people change their mind? I would have thought it only went this far, it would be continued. Yeah, I'm sure that they almost never change their mind if it ever happened. I'm sure this is not a real situation. I agree with you. The psychology is hard to imagine. Yeah, this is just what the Mishnah does with cases like this. It tries to understand what is like the end point of the ceremony? At what point has the ceremony gone too far for you to go back on it? And that just sort of gets you a sense of what the ceremony is about and what's important about the ceremony. Like what we've learned here is that the key moment is the name of God being erased or the writing being erased. That's what we've learned. The key moment of the ceremony is that. And that has the highest stakes such that if you, the consent no longer matters after the name has already been erased. Okay. Yeah, the Mishnah does this all the time, uses unlikely corner cases to just explain a principle behind things. And the principle here is that the key moment is the writing being erased. Okay. Eina maspeket lishtot ad shepaneha morikot veineha boltot vehi mitmalit gidin. So this is now the description of what would happen, what would start to happen to her, or the effects of the potion. She would barely finish if she were guilty, obviously. She would barely finish drinking until her face became yellow. So yarak in modern Hebrew is green, but in rabbinic Hebrew it means yellow, because vegetables are really yellow, not green. And her eyes bulge. And she becomes full of tendons. Like you'll see like the tendons popping in her face. So her whole face changes and becomes discolored and starts to pop. V'heim omrim, hotziuha hotziuha shelo titameha azara. They would say the people seeing, yeah, it's like being poisoned. Exactly, that's the sense here. The people who see this, the people around say, take her out, in order that she shouldn't defile the sanctuary. So this defiling the sanctuary could be a couple of different things. It could be literally defiling the sanctuary, but the Gemara understands this to mean that like when this happens, it might end up with some kind of impure discharge, which would be a problem in the sanctuary. And so therefore you need to get rid of her for the technical impurity reasons. But also we've seen already that the literal ritual impurity and the metaphorical impurity of the adulteress becomes blurred in this ceremony. Which is why we're sort of outside the temple gates. So it could just be this metaphorical, like, oh, it's turned out she's an adulteress, let's get her as far away from the temple as possible. Rather than specifically she's ritually impure, it could be still her moral impurity that we're trying to keep away from God's hope. Okay, then this is basically the best line in the whole Masechet. Im yesh la zchut haita tolala. Suddenly the entire ceremony is upended. If she has merit, then it suspends her. It suspends it for her. In other words, she might not die in the ceremony. The case where she wouldn't die is if she had merit, if she had mitzvot, if she was a, you know, had done good things for people, or as we'll see in a second, had learned Torah. There's all sorts of reasons that like that you wouldn't die if you like, you know, gave tzedakah. Or you, kept Shabbos. Like there's all sorts of reasons. If you have schut, then you don't die. The whole ceremony has been totally upended now, because like for up until now we've been assuming a one-to-one correlation between being guilty and being poisoned by the liquid, and now that's broken. It's possible that she could still be guilty. She could have actually committed adultery and the water would have no effect on her until later. The tolala means it suspends it for her. The punishment happens later or doesn't happen at all, but she'll still die later. Maybe she won't die through this particular horrible death of the poison, but she'll die at a certain later point. And it was because of this, but you won't know. There's no way to know that it was because of this. So This is an amazing line, which just totally changed all of our assumptions about what's going on. And then you'll have a bunch of people digging into this. So immediately this statement is qualified. Yesh zchut tola shana achat, yesh zchut tola shtei shanim, yesh zchut tola shlosh shanim. So this statement seems to now come along and say, there's kind of merits which would give her 1 year of suspension. There's a merit that would give her 2 years of suspension, and there's merit that would give her 3 years of suspension, implying that maybe there's no more than 3 years. So that even though the first statement seems very broad, it could be suspended forever or for many, many years. Here it seems like we're limiting the suspension for 3 years. Or alternatively, you could read the Mishnah to say that there's no conflict between these two statements. You could read it to say, there's schut for 1 year, 2 years, or 3 years, i.e., like, depending on your schut, you could suspend the punishment for any number of years. So it could be there in harmony, or it could be this is a limiting case on the previous line. So yeah, different kinds of schut. And the point being here is that surely, 100%, the best kind of merit you can have is Torah learning. That's their assumption. Like if you have learned Torah, that's the highest level of merit you can. And that's what we're now going to discuss. Let's take a little detour and talk about women learning Torah. What if she has several sorts of merit? Is it cumulative? Yes, exactly. So that's the point, Margaret. It might be that this is totally cumulative. Yeah, so exactly. So she would not be killed or only killed after 3 years. Exactly, not clear. We'll see Rabbi in a second. The next Mishnah people come along and try to maybe clarify what the anonymous Mishnah says here. But yeah, it could be that either perhaps they're imagining that she will at some point later die of the death of the Sota, like her face will go yellow, etc., at some later point, or she'll die of another cause, of other natural causes, other divine causes in that way. But we wouldn't necessarily know to bring it back directly to the Sota. It's not totally clear. Okay, Mikan Omer Ben Azai. Based on this, Ben Azai says, "Chayav Adam Lamed et Bito Torah she'im tishne teida she'azchut tolala." So this is a little bit subtle. The point he's trying to make is that a person should certainly teach their daughter Torah in order that if she drinks the Sota waters, she should know that it's zechut, it's the merit that suspends it for her. In other words, Ben Azai is worried that there are women who doubt the effectiveness of the sota drink, and that or maybe Ben Azai himself is worried about the effectiveness of the sota drink. So his point is that if a woman, a wife, drinks the water and doesn't die, because she's learnt Torah, she will assign her save, the fact that she was saved, to the fact that she has learnt Torah, and therefore she won't be eager to try adultery again, because the merit already saved her once. You can't guarantee that the merit will save her again. So in other words, the point that Ben Azai is trying to make is a bit subtle, but what he's trying to say is, if you teach your daughters Torah, they will be less incentivized to do adultery, because even if they drink the waters and don't die, they will assume that their Torah learning was the thing that saved them, and therefore they'll be less likely to try adultery in the future. Okay, so simple equation for Ben Azai: more Torah equals less adultery. but this statement, chayav, is also very strong. That a person is liable, is like, you know, obligated, required to teach their daughter Torah, and seems to be stronger. It seems like this, like she'im tishter, if she drinks the waters, is like, seems like a random hook, like a sort of like a legal loophole. Like, oh, this is the way that I can get it to the place I want to be at, which is that I want to be able to say that a person is liable to teach their daughter's Torah. The way I can do it is by justifying it through the sota. Right, it seems like it's sort of a justification rather than a direct link for Ben Azai. Because Ben Azai, apart from anything else, did not live during the temple times. So he never, like, this was not a live issue for him, that his daughters should drink sota waters. It's not a live issue. I guess he could have thought potentially the temple could be built any day and therefore I have to worry about it. But yeah, so all of this, amazing statement, such a subtle point about the sota itself, but then has this sort of broad application of teaching your daughter's Torah in general. Rabbi Eliezer comes along and also says the opposite. And again, he's going to say something that sounds very general, but actually, again, is a very subtle point about the sota itself. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Kol hamalamed et bito Torah ki'ilu malamada tiflut. Anyone who teaches their daughter Torah, it's as if they have taught them lewdness or licentiousness. There we go. Rabbi Eliezer has the opposite worry of Ben Azai. Ben Azai thinks that a woman will drink the water and not die, and therefore would chalk up her saving to the Torah learning, and therefore be less likely to do adultery in the future. Rabbi Eliezer is worried about the opposite case, which is to say that if you teach exactly, don't worry about adultery because my Torah learning will save me. Exactly right. But if you teach your daughter's Torah, they'll walk around thinking I'm immune from the sota because I've got Torah learning. I have all this schut, so I can just have as much adultery as I want and never worry about drinking the sota waters and dying from it because for sure my Torah learning will save me. Rabbi Eliezer has a much less charitable view, but like worried about the same, again, a subtle point about the sota, thinking about the same dynamic comes to a sort of a psychologically different view, right? Ben Azai is like trying to go through the psychology of a woman who went through the sota and didn't die and be like, oh, I'm never going to try that again. That was a close one. If I didn't learn Torah, I'd be in trouble. And Rabbi Eliezer is playing the psychology differently to say, they'll be like, I'll just learn Torah and then I'll have as much adultery as I want. Everything will be fine. Picture the family therapist of Mishnah times. If you have a wayward daughter and you're worried that if you marry her off, she may someday be adulterous, the solution is to teach her Torah if she has to drink. But more important than unsaid is that Torah learning will keep her busy and she'll be less likely to be wayward. On the other hand, you may never find a husband for her. Yes, exactly. Great. Yeah. We'll talk about the, will it keep her busy? We'll talk about that in a second because that comes to Rabbi Yoshua. Just curious, do we know if Ben Azai had any sons? I don't know. I don't know if we know. I don't know. I don't know. I feel like Ben Azai, is he the celibate one? One of the two, I think sometimes gets switched anyway. One of the two, I think, is famously celibate, or like basically like, I love the Torah, I can't love a woman. So I think it might be Ben Azai, in which case this actually makes even more sense. Like it's not a practical situation for him at all, if that were the case. He just, Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Let me, I will check that. But I'm pretty sure that this is Ben Azai. Okay. So so these, I'm sure you'll see these statements quoted out of context, such that the, you know, Ben Azai says, yeah, Ben Azai, great, perfect. Ben Azai said, you have to teach your daughter's Torah. And Rabbi Eliezer says, teaching it is like licentiousness. I'm like, well, yes, but actually what they're talking about is the specific case of the Sota and whether they will how they will experience psychologically surviving the Sota ritual. So they're not talking about this in general. They're talking about an extremely specific case. To the extent that there's no Sota and no chance that the Sota ritual is going to be instituted in our lifetimes, their concerns would not apply at all. You'd have to come up with a totally different way of talking about it. So this is actually an extremely limited machloket, which gets picked up in a much more broader way in other contexts. But here you go. This is how specific it is. Great, yes, great. Betrothed to Rabbi Akiva's daughter, who waited for him as her mother had waited for Akiva, but he never married her. Yes, Ben Azai, yeah. So yeah, he has a famous statement somewhere about how he loves the Torah and therefore can't get married. Now this Rabbi Yeshua has two things. The connection between what he says and what's going on in this Mishnah is not at all obvious. And the meaning of what he says is also not obvious. So we're going to see what we can do with it. Rabbi Yeshua Omer, Rotsa Isha Bakav V'Tiflut Mitisha Kabin Ufrishut. This is actually a statement which has literally nothing to do with the Sota at core. What it's about is about... it definitely comes up in the Talmud and Ketubah, if not the Mishnah. The point is about wives whose husbands travel widely. And Rabbi Yeshua says, Rotsa Isha Bakav V'Tiflut, a wife prefers to have a kav, just one kav, which is a amount of, it's a measurement, it's an amount of volume, one kav, and tiflut, and licentiousness, like a lot of sex, versus nine calves, like a significantly more wealth, ufrishut, and abstinence. So he's making a claim about the psychology of wives, that they prefer to have a poorer husband who's around more, so they can have sex more often, than a richer husband who's around less. That's his claim. I don't know whether his claim is true. But that's his claim. Nothing to do with the Sota. What it's about is about the husbands who leave their wives for a long time. It's like how often does the kind of requirement, like one of the obligations of a husband to his wife is to have sex with her, like give her sexual satisfaction. It's called the ona. And the question comes up, what if your husband has to travel? How often, depending on your career, do you have to have sex with your wife? And this comes up in that context, which is about that Rabbi Yeshua thinks that wives prefer husbands who are around but poorer than husbands who are far afield but richer. Great. Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah. I don't think there's anything specific about the nine kavim versus one kavim. But yes, it's true that in Tahara, nine kavim of water are used. Okay. Great. Ben Azai's assertion about loving the Torah too much to marry is from Yevamot. Perfect. Do we know anything about Rabbi Yeshua's wife? I don't. I don't think we do. If the reason for a statement of Ben Azai's or others' statement about teaching daughters Torah no longer exists, does that invalidate the original statement? Yeah. So it means that their concerns don't apply. They might have other grounds. They might have other grounds for saying what they say, for being chayav or it's terrible. Like. Though, by the way, Rabbi Eliezer doesn't say it's asur. Right? Rabbi Eliezer never says it's forbidden. Just says that you got to watch out. So they might have other reasons for what they're saying, but it does undermine their reasons they give here. And therefore, you'd have to come up with other things going on. Yeah, so what's the relationship between Rabbi Yeshua and everything else in this Mishnah? It's not totally clear. It could be, one thing that it could be about is trying to explain the reason behind Rabbi Eliezer to a certain extent. Rabbi Eliezer might be saying, "Kol hamalamed et bito Torah, teaching your Torah is like teaching them licentiousness." And Rabbi Yeshua might come along to say, "Like, yeah, they don't really have the sense of separation from the physical world, from a preshut of separating from sex that is required of Torah learning. Like, to be a real Torah scholar, you have to leave your family for months at a time. and you have to dedicate your entire life to Torah instead of the physical world. And it could be that Rabbi Yeshua is claiming that wives don't have that ability, don't have that sense, don't have that, those priorities, and therefore are ill-suited to Torah learning. I said wives specifically, by the way, because Isha normally means wife rather than woman per se. So yeah, and there's obviously some gendered overlapping between single women and wives. Whenever you see a statement about Isha, you've got to think about, is it kind of statement that applies specifically to wives or to women in general? Here, he might be saying women in general, but he might also be saying specifically wives in the sense that it's related to her husband specifically, and it's what a wife wants in a marriage rather than necessarily what a woman wants in general. And it might also be, so that's why I said wives. Anyway, so Rabbi Yeshua, not totally clear what he's doing here. The other thing that happened is that we use the same word tiflut, which may also be the connection, right? The licentiousness. It may be that the connection is nothing other than here are two rare statements about women that use this rare word tiflut. There may be no other connection at all. Was this the Rabbi Yeshua was famously unattractive? I don't know that he was famously unattractive. I don't know. Either way. One of the classical ways to overturn halakhic principle, if the original reason for what they say doesn't exist and no other reasons can be created. Yes, correct. It's one of the major problems why people have objections to coming up with the reasons for mitzvot. Because if you have a reason for mitzvot, you say this mitzvah is about exactly this and nothing else, then when the reason no longer applies, the mitzvah vanishes. So it can be a very dangerous thing to do. Like if you like say kashrut is about health, like kashrut is because it's a healthier lifestyle. Well, then if scientists come along and prove that it's not a healthier lifestyle, then the whole of kashrut is just gone. So it's a very dangerous justification. Anyway, Hu Haya Omer, we'll finish here. Rabbi Yeshua has a second statement. Hu Haya Omer, Chasid Shoteh, V'Rasha Arum, V'Isha Frusha, U'Makot Prushin, Hari Elu Mechalei Olam. Here is a list of people who destroy the world. This statement feels like it belongs more in Masechet Avot than in Masechet Sota, but there you go. The people is a pious fool, a cunning, wicked person, a Isha Frusha, an abstinent woman, an abstinent wife, Umakot Prushin, and the strikes of the Pharisees, Hare Elu Mechalei Olam. These are those who destroy the world. So I'm not going to go into detail. We can go over this next time. But basically, Chassid Shoteh, the classic example is somebody who, given by the Gemara, somebody who refuses to save a drowning woman because he'll look at the woman. That's a Chassid Shoteh. He's like so pious that he won't even look at women, but is a Shoteh because he won't save someone who needs saving. Rasha Arum is someone who's just cunning, who applies law to themselves differently than others. Isha Frusha, abstinent woman, that seems to be the connection, or abstinent wife, right? Because we had the word Frishut here. So it's Tiflut, Frishut, Prishut. So that's what it seems to be, an abstinent wife. And Makot Prushim is a big deal that people argue about a lot what this means. And we're not going to have time to talk about it right now. We'll talk about it later. Right. I'll see you tomorrow. We'll pick up with this statement from Rabbi Yeshua, Makot Prushim specifically. Makot Prushim. Thank you.